First off, start by recording.
Yay! I was just about to cut it.
First off, start by telling you a bit about the networks that you're gonna that you see, networks and organizations whose logos you see on your screen. Mm-hmm. So if you're joining this webinar, then you're probably affiliated with the National Collaborative on for Infants and Toddlers. So CSSC is one of the national partners participating in Insight. So CSSP is a national nonprofit policy organization that connects community action, public system reform, and policy change to create a fair and just society with all where all children and families thrive. So here at CSSP, we have our EC Link communities. So EC Link stands for Early Childhood Learning and Innovation Network for Communities.
Hold on one second. Can I don't want to mute everyone because then I'm but could folks just when you're not speaking, if you could mute yourself, it will cut down on the background. I'm sorry to interrupt, but one of those logistics that we didn't cover. So awesome, yes. Thank you.
So and let me know if you can't hear me if I'm not close enough to my phone. So here at CSSP, we have our Early Childhood Learning and Innovation Network for Communities. So EC Link is a network of 14 communities who have come together to learn, but also to test and demonstrate effective approaches to local early childhood systems that work well across multiple sectors. So 10 of our EC Link communities are participating in Insight, 10 of the 14. So today you'll hear from parent leaders from two of our EC Link communities that are also participating in Insight. That's Boston, Massachusetts, and Grand Rapids, Michigan. So if you move to the next slide for me, Malia, I'll tell you a little bit about who you're gonna hear from and then throw it over to Lisa for our icebreaker. So today you'll hear from Lisa Malara, who's a parent leader in our Boston EC Link community, Anthony Queen, who is a parent representative in our Grand Rapids community, maybe Stephanie Doyle, a senior associate here at the Center for the Study of Social Policy, Malia Franklin, who is a consultant on family engagement and leadership, and me, Erin Robinson, who I mentioned is currently a policy analyst at the Center for the Study of Social Policy. So I'll throw it over to Lisa to do the icebreaker and then to Malia to give some background.
All right, Lisa, it's you.
So good afternoon. My name is Lisa Malara, and I'm a parent leader in the Boston area. I am the mother of three boys. One of my boys has autism, and one was born with a club foot, and one has a learning disability, which led me to the parent advocacy work. I am now a parent partner with the East Boston Family Engagement Network, conducting welcome baby visits and ages and stages screening. In addition, promotes early literacy through the parent-child activities and workshops. I'm a community person. I am involved in many organizations, such as Friends of the East Boston Library, the Parent Ambassador of the Children's Museum, a Climate Ready Leader, and a Parent Ambassador of the Boston School Finder. I also volunteer with the Boston Alliance for Young Children's Social Emotional Wellness System of Care, Parent Advisory Council, United Way Grant Review, Union Capital Boston, One East Boston, the Peace Walk, the Families for Depression Awareness Council, the East Boston Alliance for Support, Treatment, Intervention, and Education Coalition, and the Boston Fed Family Council. Whew, that's a lot of things that I try to find to do with my time. So I'm here today to talk about what does equity mean to you? And what does equity mean to me? What it means to me as a community person who chairs a lot of these awesome council is that I find that equity is missing. So I go looking for equity in all these work. And what I fail to mention out of all these things that I do is that I'm a biracial family. I am from Vietnam. And my parents, well, my mom's from Vietnam and my dad's from France. And my children are from Vietnam, obviously. And my husband is from El Salvador. So we're a mixed household. And when I think of equity, I think of all these places that my children are exposed to with all these different organizations. And equity comes up a lot because when we go for services at all these great locations, people look at us kind of strangely in the sense that, oh, where are you guys from? And it's a very tough question because it defines you when you go for services, for instance. So when we look at equity, it matters when you're looking at system of care. When you're looking at services, so equity matters. And it's tough because, you know, levels of services defines you. It defines you when you go to school. It defines you when you get services. And it's a tough conversation to have because you have to check off these boxes when it comes to equity. You know, you have to check off whether you're Asian, whether you're white, whether you're Latino. So I think we're going to do a polling at this point. Am I correct, Malia and Aaron? Where we're going to ask in one word what equity means to you. And we're going to see how hard it is. When you think of equity, what's one word that comes to mind?
And you're going to use the chat, so it's a little different than a poll. And then everyone will see their... everyone else's chat when we send the, well, you can look at it or when we send the meeting record. Thanks, Lisa. And while you guys are thinking and entering your own ideas of equity, actually, Lisa, did you want to talk through the slide a little bit, the image, or do you want to do that after?
I can chat to this while you guys are thinking of the word equity. So we have this slide where it's come up a lot. I think most people have seen it, where, you know, we talk about the equality, the equity, and the liberation. And I think the slide speaks volume where you see these three kids and you see, you know, what's equitable about it, whether, you know, there's a fence and, you know, thinking outside of the box is you just get rid of the fence completely because our lives and, you know, we're checking off boxes when we're filling out all these school forms and any type of forms. And I really hate forms, you know, coming from a mixed household. I hate that we have to, you know, there's never a form where you check off mixed race, right? It's always white, Asian, Hispanic, Latino, not Latino. And I hate it. I absolutely hate it because if it's equitable, it wouldn't even be there in the first place. It shouldn't matter where you're from. So.
Yeah, thanks. What I like about this slide is there's often a lot of, basically people use equity and equality interchangeably. typing without their mute on, if you could turn on your mute, that would be so appreciated. So really just like seeing the fact that equality means giving everyone the same thing. But when you look at equity, it's really about how do you allocate resources and think about barriers and access in a way that supports people from where they are. But taking it a step further, you know, how about, as Lisa mentioned, how about taking away the barrier entirely? And then what I like about this box is that it leaves space for conversation about equity that even goes further than what's shown here. I'm going to take a moment in Stephanie's place because Stephanie is a parent of young child and is dealing with the things that matter in that role. Just to tell you a little bit about how we got here in terms of this conversation about family engagement, parent leadership, and equity. and sort of what role has EC Link played to facilitate that dialogue and also to take action. And so Lisa's gonna talk in more detail, but just briefly, EC Link has had a strand of work that I guess since 2016 that has focused on family engagement. And that was based on some availability of some funding and some mutual interest on behalf of EC Link communities. The first phase, which was the year of 2016, we created the Ripples of Transformation, which will be in another slide, I believe, later on, in terms of the resource. It's a toolkit that really kind of pushed, expanded the boundaries of the definition of family engagement and suggested a new model and some tools to think about family engagement in an expanded way. And in the course of doing that work, it really became clear that race equity was a central driving force for effective, authentic family engagement. So if you look at, you know, the outcomes for children and the barriers for families to engage, there's a correlation to race. You know, Lisa was spelling out some of it. And so you can't really have effective family engagement unless you have a deeper conversation and acknowledgement and action around race equity. And so that sparked in the next phase of work a deeper conversation, which Lisa's going to talk about in a second, that really made, it was a gathering to create a manifesto for race equity and parent leadership in early childhood. In between, we've been working with communities in the strand of family engagement to test new strategies and to really help facilitate them taking on what they, kind of assessing where they are now and taking on meaningful actions to move themselves to the place they want to be with regard to parent leadership and equity. We're going to have some tidbits on a new tool around that. But this, Anthony and Lisa are here as representatives of a new EC Link Parent Leader Network, which they will also talk about. But that's representing a new phase of work that has evolved through the work that has happened before. So just to summarize, EC Link has had this organic process of redefining, engaging in conversation about and taking action on family engagement, and that is about to kick off into a new phase. And as Lisa mentioned, the conversation about equity is often separated from the conversation about parent leadership and family engagement, and we're here to bring it together today. So that is my contribution. Erin, did I leave anything out?
No, I think you covered it perfectly and succinctly.
Okay. And so back to Lisa, do you want to do this or do you want me to do this? We're a well-oiled machine, as you can tell.
Okay, so in today's presentation, what's the mutual benefit of engaging parents as partners and the leaders in early childhood systems? What are the connections between race equity and authentic family engagement? What changes do we need to make to remove barriers to families who want to engage with systems?
Lisa,
can we have Anthony introduce himself at this point?
Anthony, why don't you introduce yourself, and how about you tell us about what the EC Link Parent Leader Network is about?
All right. My name is Anthony Queen. I have been a parent rep. I'm currently a parent liaison. I started in this work, I should say this work started with me 6 years ago when my son was born. His mom passed away 30 days after he was born. And this is my first child. And so I reached out. Well, no, I didn't reach out. I was at one of his wellness visits, and a nurse came up to me. And, of course, I had been there before, and she had heard my laugh, which is kind of distinct, and my smile. And she told me that I had an inviting smile, so she felt okay to come up to me and tell me about home visiting and all that that entailed. And from there, I was receiving home visits for my son. Fortunately, he doesn't have any deficiencies except me being his dad. But other than that, he is fine and well. God bless. And I received home visiting for about 2 years. After that, I was asked to come on board as a parent representative. It might be something called different in your neck of the woods, but it was a parent representative. And really, I just gave my opinion about the programs that were being featured here in Kent County. And one of my main inputs was, or I was asked a lot about, why they weren't getting that ROI, that return in their investment in the minority community. And so I delved into that. From there, I did that for about 3 years, and then I was asked to become a parent liaison, which is kind of the same thing as a parent representative, but it's more detailed work, learning about budgets and reports and so on and so forth. Throughout that time, I did journey out to Oakland to be part of the CSSP. We did have that convening, and I've been a part of the steering committee ever since. I believe that was, what, a year ago? Yeah, okay. And we've been part of those four parents that are on the screen that you're currently looking at. It was part of that. And since that convening, we've carried on and we've done the manifesto, which I've been able to present 4 times at different parts of Kent County to different organizations. And that's been very well received. I've mentioned before that at one of them where I presented it, they never had feedback like that before in all of their meetings since they've been meeting, which is about 4 or 5 years. So the manifesto can help break down one of the barriers about getting to race. Fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you look at it, race is a part of the work that we do. And other than putting it in the closet and trying to hide it, it's best that it comes to the forefront. And that way you can deal with it and it's not something that's lingering, then you can carry on. In this work, at least in Michigan, it's about 98.9% women. So I'm one of the few men who were in this work. I'm proud to be a part of this work. I never thought that I would be in this work or in this field. I have a degree in business, and that's what I was doing until what happened with my son got me into this line of work, and I'm glad to be a part of it. Unlike Lisa, I'm not gonna name all the organizations and committees I'm a part of, because again, being a male, then being African-American male, I get asked to do a whole lot. And sometimes we need to just turn some things down because it can be overwhelming at times. But I'm glad to be a part of this network. One thing I like about the EC Link is that it's not just a talk, it's about action. We're not paralysis by analysis. We try to move forward, and if we have to go back and cover something, that's fine. But we just want to try to make a difference to these organizations. And again, we know race plays a big part of that, and we try to knock down that one barrier.
Thanks, Anthony. I'll just add a little background on the Parent Leader Network. This group of parent leaders, some of whom are, all of them are on the picture you're looking at, but there's also me and Aaron and Stephanie. Basically, came out of this meeting we did in Oakland to create the manifesto, and a year ago, we started meeting to envision a space for parents in EC Link community to collaborate with each other, to represent the parent voice, and to advocate for the ideas and policies and actions in the manifesto. So this is kicking off from a planning phase expansion in May. So we're really excited about that. And these parent leaders have been 100% committed. They show up for everything. It's amazing. So I'm going to stop there and kick it back to Lisa, who's going to take us to Oakland. Lisa, I don't
know. Oh,
there you are.
Yes. Yes, I am here. So on this call today with me are, as you can hear from Anthony, Malia, Stephanie, who will be joining shortly. So we were part of a group of 40 parent leaders and staff of Early Childhood Agency who met in Oakland in January of 2018 to create this manifesto. We wanted to share with you of why this manifesto is important and how we can use it to make the systems more responsive families. Bear with me as I'm flipping through notes. So the vision and action for this manifesto was that it was the relationship between race equity and authentic family engagement that captures what we believe and how the beliefs shape our future work. The priorities and for learning action and funding for future and local collaborative efforts to advance a race equity and family engagement manifesto. So those were, you know, the talking words of this manifesto. But the convening, it was powerful. It was a lot of hard work. It took days of a really long meeting. Just imagine, I mean, majority of the people who came, a lot of people were from Oakland, but the people like us, we came from Boston, we came from Connecticut. So we were facing a 3-hour time difference to sit in this meeting to make this manifesto. So it was a lot of blood, it was a lot of sweat, it was a lot of delirium because a 3-hour time difference. But we had this belief that this manifesto was going to change. It was a very important document, and we believed in it because we had this powerful, you know, dream. We imagined that we were coming from all these different states, and that we were going to come together, and we were going to dream up this document, and you know, it came to life. We got the document done, and we presented it. Anthony presented it. I presented it. Other leaders presented it, and we believed in it. And here we are today, you know, a year later. So our belief was that this document was going to change, but it would only change if the agencies stood behind us. So EC-Link stood behind us, the Center for Study of Social Policy stood behind us, but now we need more agencies to stand behind this document, but it's also a partnership.
Should I go to the next slide, Lisa?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's right. Here we are.
But barriers. So this is, where things get back to the icky feel of what's the barrier, examples of barriers. So I will tell you a story of I had this family who was living in a shelter, and you know, her case manager was telling her she needs a social security card. Go get a social security card and we can help you. Simple enough. But no one had any concept of any idea that it was hard for her to get a social security card. So me, as being a parent, you know, I took time out of my day and I said, you know what, we're just gonna call her Vanessa. So I took Vanessa down to the local social security office and I sat with her. And then I realized that she had no idea how to get a social security card. So we went in, told her to type in her social security number, sat down. She didn't know how to fill out the form. For us, you know what I mean? Even English is not my first language, but you know, I came here when I was 3 years old, and you know, I grew up here in the American school system. But that form was not easy for her to fill out. You know, we figure, put your first name here, put your last name here, your address here. She couldn't follow the logic of the form. It was very hard for her. she came from Haiti, and filling out a form was not easy. So fill out the form, and the next thing, the second barrier for her, you know, just curious, but not a number. It said A256. She had no idea what that meant. We were sitting there for over 2 hours before even I made that mistake. I had no idea that she didn't know that her number was called. And 2 hours later, we were, and then same thing. We had to go back in line, punch the number again, get another ticket number, because she didn't realize that was what the number was. And I told her, I said, now pay close attention. When they called your number again, we go up to the counter. So something as easy as that. So we finally made it around, and she was able to submit her paperwork to get a Social Security card. So in your life, now that I've told you that story, what are barriers that your family faced? Because, and then I learned something after this. I've learned something called stages of immigrant parent involvement, that they actually go through something. So immigrant parents actually faces multiple challenges. They face on basic survival needs, working longer hours, multiple jobs, basic information. They need language support. It's a lot of things. So you're talking about equity and immigrant parents.
That's such a great story. And if people are so moved, you can write more examples in the chat of barriers that you've either encountered or witnessed, just to kind of flesh out the picture. But that's such a powerful story.
So when we're looking at barriers, what causes the barriers? Is it people, structure, system? So what are the common threads? Knowledge, power, and privilege. So what roles does the racism play?
So just thinking about that story, Lisa, I'm curious how you would break it down about the causes of the barrier.
So looking at that story, I know now that it's racism that we don't realize that as systems that immigrant families, they need more support. You know, they need help with the language support. They need, it's a system.
Right.
So I can offer effective strategies to support immigrant families, like assisting them with filling out forms.
Right. And the you had more knowledge, so you were able to use that knowledge to support her. But it's so difficult when you're in a situation where you don't even have a Social Security number. You are, you are really stripped of your power and ability to get what you need. And it's a different experience for people who are not immigrants or who are not people of color, who may have access to everything, such as a ride, legal advice, whatever it is that you need, or a job that you can take time off of. These are structures and systems, and then sometimes people, but primarily it's set up to create a barrier. And I know that Anthony's going to share some of that as well when we move on.
I was going to mention real quick, one of the barriers that I faced when I was trying to get assistance with my son was just being a male. Everything, literature, the way that they spoke, the way that the workers spoke to me, it was all geared towards women. And even the aesthetics of walking into the building, there would be 90,000 pictures of women, women with kids, women that were home with kids. And yet they would advertise family and there wouldn't be one picture of a dad. I mean, not one. And luckily, after 4 years of me hemming and hawing about it, that has changed in some of these agencies here in King County. But if you're going to advertise a tour for a family and not have one picture of a dad on a wall or anywhere, that's kind of hard for a male to feel comfortable in that environment. It's already, like I said, 98% women run here in King County. So you walk into an agency and just, you know, while you're waiting for someone to come and greet you, and you're looking around, you're just seeing picture after picture after picture of women on the wall.
Great. So, Lisa, back to Pam. If someone is interested in moving stuff around on their desk, we would so appreciate it if you muted. I can't tell who it is. Perfect. All right. Back to you, Lisa.
Yes. So, what is parent engagement? I think each agency really needs to do reflect on their particular agency and look at what it is that they're doing and how they are engaging their particular parent, because I've seen everything where they think that parent engagement is sending home a flyer and they think that's engaging. Some think that parent engagement is, you know, we invite them over and we had a pizza party. And so I think they really need to look at how they're engaging their parents. And the best way to engage parents is actually having a conversation with parents and seeing, you know, how can we help you, and really partnering with parents and inviting parents and not making decisions for parents, but it is, you know, and it's really partnering with parents. That is true parent engagement. And don't call it parent engagement because you invited that one parent there, and really reshifting your focus, because to engage parent is really partnering with them.
And I think just looking at this continuum up at the top, mm-hmm. the little boxes, both, well, in particular, Anthony, just in telling his story about starting with home visiting and then moving into being a partner, a leader, and an advocate, making change, like that is an example of someone who, of an expanded vision of parent engagement, that agencies really need to provide opportunities along that continuum for those parents who are motivated and interested, and that can be done in a lot of different ways without recreating the wheel. And that's one of the things we're really hoping that agencies take a close look at, is how are you creating a leadership pathway?
Yeah, and it is really parent to parent, because most parents will listen to another parent. And if you find that one parent that is really, you know, the leader, that's how you get other parents on board, is the best way of getting your parents. Because I get that question asked a lot, is like, well, how do we find parents? You have to find one parent first to get other parents on board. And that's your, you know, that's like your seed parent. It's finding that one parent who can influence other parents, and you will find more parents that way. But you have to start with one. You can't start with no parents and then start building your parent engagement around no parents. You need to start with a parent. You can't build a whole parent engagement model around something that you think, oh, this will work really great. We're going to have this parent leadership program. And if you've never had any parent on that board, it won't work.
Go ahead, Anthony.
I was just going to say, just to piggyback on that, it's really a way that a lot of agencies that you can save a good chunk of your budget, is once you get a parent who believes in your program and is out there, we all know that's the best form of advertising. So if a parent is, quote unquote, giving the program props, that's going to be your best form of advertising. That's going to bring a whole lot of sincere parents to your program, instead of spending all that money and you're not getting nothing on your return on your investment. You know, I I was part of a couple of programs when they kept saying, well, we're spending all this money, we're providing all this, but you're not getting buying in from the parents. You can spend it till the cows come home, but if they're not buying in, you're just spending money.
That's truth. Lisa, back to you.
See, that's what I mean. Like, what do we change first? You don't build a program for parents without parents. So that's one of the things that, you know, I hate it where they're like, oh, but, you know, we came up with this great program. The parents are going to love it. But if you don't have any parents' input, they're not going to love it.
I think.
And then
go ahead.
And then same thing with they're like, oh, but there's no money. But I've seen a lot of new grants out there. And a lot of the new grant structures out there, they are building parent engagement. It is the new hot button out there. So even when you have your grants, I've seen a lot of agencies where they added the grant for parent engagement, and they think parent engagement is that pizza party or that flyer. It's not. And the best buy-in, like Anthony say, is that you get that parent on board, and you've done it. So what do you change first? Get the parent buy-in. And you do it right the first time around. And don't just put it on paper. It's not going to work for you.
Yeah, and I think that what I've encountered on the agency side and is that a lot of times agency staff and leaders aren't even really aware of the barriers that their agency creates. From the front desk person to the CEO, in terms of how parents feel when they walk in the door, if you're not standing in a parent's shoes or listening to a parent, you're not going to know how that parent feels. And then, for example, I've encountered where an agency doesn't have the ability to give a parent a stipend because of a restriction or even a job that is built in to the structure. So that's, I think, a great example of something to pay attention to, like what would you need to do in your structure to take away barriers? And then changing the systems themselves is a lot about policy change, but it's also about, again, bringing more parents in as peer educators, helping other parents navigate the system. There are a lot of opportunities, and you kind of have to do it all. You can't just say, oh, we're just going to change our individual beliefs and attitudes and behavior if you're not also changing the structures and then looking at the systems to see what kind of influence you can have to change that. Anything else on this slide before we switch? Okay. So now we're going to shift over to Anthony, who's going to walk us through. Well, thank you so much, Lisa, for your sharing your knowledge and wisdom and those great stories. And we're going to hear from you, I'm sure, later. But we're going to shift over to Anthony, who's going to walk us through the manifesto.
Yes. The first thing is just to let you know that what you're seeing on the slide is not the total commitment. It's a synopsis of the commitment. So if you want to go to the first one.
Sure thing.
Never got screen? Okay. Mm-hmm. The manifesto challenges early childhood systems agencies to increase equitable outcomes through adoption of the five commitments. The commitment number one is challenge racism.
You want me to go that one?
Yes, please.
There we go.
Okay. Instead of reading you what's there, I'm sure we all can read that, I'm going to talk about the commitments that are part of the manifesto. I'm going to talk about one or two bullet points. So commitment number one is challenge racism. And one of our bullet points is ensure the existing workforce is committed to race equity and parent leadership, and they have the needed knowledge, skills, and support. And one of the things that surprised me is when I presented this one time, and let's face it, most of the programs that are here in Grand Rapids, they're run by or they're supervised by middle-aged white women. And one of the things that they thanked me for when I present the manifesto is that they didn't know how to approach this with their workers or their clientele. So it was one way of just knocking down that barrier and opening up that line of communication And after the meeting was over, they were like, this is one of the most important meetings that they ever attended. So if you're having trouble getting to that point, or you know it's something that needs to be discussed, use the manifesto. That's what it's there for. Another one is build the knowledge, skills, and capacity of policymakers and system leaders to promote race equity and engage families. Again, we kind of touched on this, but what sounds good up there in the high rise, once it gets down to the floor of the minority communities especially, it's not going to work. You know, it sounds good and it feels good and it might make you feel warm and fuzzy inside, but if it's not doing what it's intended to do, it's just a waste of time.
Should I go the next one?
Sure, would you?
Now, here we go.
Okay. Next one is embrace parent leadership. And one of the ones that I always talk about when I speak about the manifesto is one of the things that you have to remember, especially with the minority community, is just a generation ago, if a state worker came to a house, it was never a good outcome. I mean, it never worked out good for the family. So you have to remember that, and you have to be conscious of that. And when you're asking, you know, whether you're going to them or they're coming to you, be aware of that, that just a generation ago, anytime a state worker got involved, and that was one of the things that surprised me, is that we are looked upon as state workers, because some of the men who I spoke to, they didn't look at me as a state worker, but their family and their friends looked at me as a state worker. And I'm African-American, they still looked at me that way. So I would say that's one of the things you need to be aware of. And if you're going to embrace parent leadership, really embrace it. Because like I said, the parents are going to be your best form of advertisement, your best word of mouth. And if they're not really feeling the program, or they don't feel that you're really engaged, it's going to get out. And, you know, that can set your program back months, years, who knows. Commit to a strength-based approach with families, recognizing and bolstering the strengths that families have and asking them to identify where they need support. Because one of the things, and Lisa just touched on this, one of the things is I had a worker who told me what my problem was, how they were going to fix it, and then how great my family was going to be afterwards. And the whole time, and every time, I was just looking at her like, this lady's crazy. So get the input from the parents to know what they want, to know the best way to help their family, because they are their children's best teacher. Number three, prioritize resources. And one of the things that Lisa touched on, and one of the things that we're doing here in King County, is they are starting to write in that line item for parents. Because I've been at meetings where the first thing when they talked about the budget, and they didn't get as much as they thought they were going to get, first thing they wanted to cut was the parent input. But your agency is here to help parents and help families, but the first thing you wanted to cut was the parent input. So allocate robust resources to develop parent leadership and advocacy, and stay committed to that. Maybe you go, you know, instead of having this for lunch, you might have that for lunch, which is a little cheaper, but it's going to help you down the road. Accept short-term wins, which will equal long-term outcomes. So, you know, if you might not be able to do it all, but if you just do a little bit. And I'm telling you, once them parents buy in, because one of the things that made my parent liaison successful is I had fathers who were happy with, or they knew that I was like genuine, I was real in what I was trying to do for them. Because there before the grace of God go I. So when I was a full-time dad, all of a sudden it was like kind of thrust upon me. I was out there with a lifeline, and I was grateful for what I received, and I just wanted to give that to the fathers whom I'm working with. So parents know if you really want to help them be an advocate for their family and their community.
Next slide.
Yes, please.
Okay.
Commitment number four, create career pathways. And all I can say about that one is look at me. I never thought I would be in this field. I just thought I was going to receive some help from my son and keep it moving. But things opened up, and I was asked to be a part of it. And there were times when I was asked to be a part of something or be a part of a committee. And after one or two meetings, I stopped showing up because I knew it was just like they wanted to be able to check a box. They wanted to be able to tell the state, yeah, we have an African-American dad, or we have a dad on the committee. And I just was like, no, not for me. If you're going to do it and you want me to be involved, I want to know that there is going to be equity to what I'm saying, that it's just going to be taken just as serious as what the next parent is saying. Modified jobs is one of the bullet points on the create career pathways is modified job descriptions to substitute life experience for educational attainment. And what I always say about that is if you have Jenny, who's been taking care of her little brother and her nephew for eight years, ever since she was in junior high, she's been taking care of him ever since. Maybe she might not have those letters after her name, but she's got that life experience. So maybe to help your program, if you were to hire her, people who come in are going to see people who look like themselves, and that's always powerful. And maybe substitute those letters behind the name with her life experience and see where that gets you. And they're going to be more grateful because they got the job. One of the things, once those who join the network will get to see is my email, and it says collaboration goes at the speed of trust, and that's between people, programs, and families, and parents. Once you build that trust, then that collaboration will open up. But until they trust you, it's just going to be kind of a one-way street. And lastly, maximize equitable outcomes. And that's all we've been talking about is equity. Diversify staff. One of the bullet points is diversify staff and leadership to reflect the communities they serve. And like I said, one of the things that I always get buy-in with dads, like dads who I don't know and I meet them for the first time, they may have gotten the word of mouth about me, and then they see someone who looks like, and I always remember one of the first fathers that I helped was, he was like, man, it's about time they see somebody who looked like them on the other side of the table. I don't take that lightly, you know, I don't take that and try to use that. I take that to try to assist those families and assist those men. Be accountable for commitments made and hold partners accountable. And that's one of the things with the collaboration. You might be doing all you can to assist the family, and then once they move on or their kids outgrow your program or whatever it may be, if you doing a handoff of a family to another program and that family is not having the same commitment as you have or as your program had, then all that good work that's been done has just been erased. So make sure those who you partner with want those maximal equitable outcomes as well. And those are the five commitments.
Thank you. And Lisa, before we transition to the rest of y'all participating, I just want to make sure, Lisa, if you had any thoughts you wanted to share on the manifesto.
Nope. I think Anthony did an awesome job.
Absolutely. That was fantastic. Really, really succinct and informative. So now it is your turn, and let's see. I'm going to look at chat, and so I invite you all. Oops, I got to plug in my computer. I invite you all to type in questions in chat. And then I think that's just going to be easier with the numbers. And then I'll read it aloud. And then whoever wants to answer it can answer it. So I see some comments that this was so helpful and eye-opening. But questions or other reflections, where are you all at? How does this description of best practices hit you? Vanessa says, I love the idea of employing a parent as a peer educator. Yeah, both Anthony and Lisa had some powerful examples. I also have heard, however, we were on a call, I don't know, Volusia County is on this call, but where someone talked about background checks and how there is a systemic, so if you're trying to, and some systems require a background check and will not clear a background check to someone who's been convicted of a felony. So it is, that's an example of how systemic racism is that you have to like work on across multiple systems in order to create the kind of the liberation we're talking about. That if you want to volunteer, if you want to be part of something, but you can't because of a past felony, then that's an example of a barrier that's in a different system, but is still very relevant.
So I check up on the background check thing.
Uh-huh.
So with the felony, right, it's up to the adults in the room whether you're comfortable with someone with a felony, but you cannot work with children. Mm-hmm. So let's say I'm running a parents group. As long as the parents in the room are okay with someone with a felony, that's the only disclosure you can have. And it could be a blind disclosure. So you can just send out an email to the group. If you are okay with someone with a felony joining this group, and you don't have to say who, that's how you get around the felony with the parents group.
That's really helpful.
And we have done it in that instance.
That's great.
So I think for parent to parent, majority of the time, they're not going to say, no, I'm not going to join this group because someone in this room has a felony.
Right.
Because parents are more understanding, as long as there's no children.
Right, but it might be that an agency has in place as a policy that might need to be changed.
Yeah, it's for parents group, though. So let's say I want to have a new mom's group. Right, and it's just new moms, and someone in that group has a felony. It's up to the new moms to welcome her or not welcome him or her. Right. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it doesn't reflect on the agency, because like let's say the East Boston Social Center, we run NA and NAA, so everyone there most likely has a felony.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I heard
someone. Hi, this is Lynn in Volusia County.
Oh, hi.
Hi there. I'm not sure if I'm the only one on today from Volusia County, so I'm not an expert if anyone else wants to jump in. But there is a process in Florida for those who don't pass the standard background check required by agencies. I understand you were talking about parent groups, but for agencies to be able to work in an organization, we do have a process to go through for those who don't clear the standard background check. So if there's anyone else on Volusia on the line that has more information than that, please chime in. I just wanted to let you know that there is a process there.
Good, good. I have a great question from Jennifer Brooks to Anthony and Lisa. Lisa, I've been in debates about having parent voices within larger advisory committees versus having a separate advisory committee made up of parents. It's critical to include parent voice in our expert committees with their lived experience and expertise. But is there a way to make these experiences welcoming and inclusive to parents? I think both y'all could speak to that.
I'll let you go first, Lisa.
I think parents should be on both committees. Like, I think you should have one where they're part of the larger one and have one separate for them so that they can have their own space. Does that make sense?
Is there a way, what advice would you give to make these experiences of being on a larger advisory committee more welcoming and inclusive?
What I'm trying to understand, is she trying to get those who are making the decision makers to buy in, have parents part of the committee?
I think the question is about, is it better to have parents in a larger advisory committee with other decision makers, or to have a separate space for parents to come up with feedback, et cetera. And Lisa said both. And then the follow-up question was, what can be done to make those experiences, especially in working alongside with other professionals, more inclusive and welcoming?
Well, I think I agree with Lisa. I think the parents should be on both. And for the second part of that, I would say, well, I always tell when I just had a couple of dads come to a meeting that was like, you know, all the suit and tie guys, people. And I just told them to be themselves, to be authentic. And when it was time to speak up, don't bite your tongue, to be respectful of those who are sitting in the room with you, but don't be fearful. Because the only way you're going to make change is if you have a seat at the table. And that's step one, is to have a seat at the table. Now that you have that seat, make it a priority to make something out of it. Do something with it.
Balcony. Lisa, do you have anything else that you would recommend?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Anthony that, you know, that they should be themselves. But if there's a dress code, then they need to follow the dress code. So, you know, be professional. And then just let them know what to expect. So, but I think everyone needs to be professional and on both sides of the table.
And I would say last thing, make sure you introduce them. Don't have a parent just sit there not knowing who's in the room with them.
Yeah.
Well, I know both of you all have talked about the importance of when you're working alongside paid professionals about also being paid. And then just as a follow-up, and I hope I pronounce this right, Muya Hayes, and I apologize if I did not pronounce that right, asked, what's the definition of being professional?
Well, I think one of the things that Lisa mentioned, oh, go ahead, Lisa.
Yeah, I mean, and it means being respectful on both sides, because there's many times where I've been places where they look down on parents because we're parents and they don't think that we know anything. But you know what I mean? We know just as much. So that's why I use the term be respectful. So just because there's parents in the room, does that mean that, you know, they can talk down on the parents? So be professional and be respectful. So if there's a dress code, expect the parents to follow the dress code. So if everyone is in there in their business attire, do not have the parents show up in jeans and t-shirts. So it's be respectful on both sides of the table. But also don't ignore the parents either. There's many times where a parent comes to a meeting and they're not given any leeway to talk, and that's just as boring and it's rude. So if it's a meeting and the parents are part of the conversation, then have them part of the conversation, but don't have them sitting there twirling their thumbs to do nothing. But that's a waste of their time too. So have a purpose for them to be there. If they're just there just to be there, then don't bring them.
Anthony, you have something to add?
No, I think she covered it all. Like I said, the one thing is, one thing I always make sure is when the first time I might bring a new dad to, you know, one of those meetings, I always make sure I introduce them. I always ask those in the audience, you know, you don't have to come and bow anything to the new parent, but come and say hello, just so they can feel comfortable and know that, you know, a parent has more than just one label. We all have more than one label, whether you're a parent or not. We all wear many hats during the day. So does the parent.
Okay, we got two other great comments, questions, and I apologize, it's Maya. And Maya has a follow-up, but what if the parents do not have anything else to wear other than jeans and t-shirts? I ask because I've been in situations where parents did not have access to professional clothing.
Then look for programs. Like, we have something called Dress for Success that will provide professional clothing for parents. I don't know in your county if they have something similar, but look for any programs that do offer that.
And I think
I don't know. Yeah.
I think that it's also, you could argue that perhaps the advisory committee, you know, this more professional setting might need to make some changes to be more flexible and to be more accepting of meeting people where they are. I think that your tip, Lisa, is a point well taken, and it will definitely create a smoother, you know, way for a parent to fit in. But I think we do have to, Stephanie Doyle, hi Stephanie, is also saying, I wonder if you can change the dress code for the rest of the group. So I think that it's a conversation, and it's like you said, it has to happen on both sides. And then I don't know who, N, but it's N Lee. Anthony, I agree. I also suggest if we assume that several of our parents' group might have concerns that need to be addressed, then have a parents' meeting at least twice in advance to increase their successful participation in the integrated group. Yeah, that's a great, I couldn't agree more that that's a great strategy.
Yeah, so that's part of that leadership development is where, you know, you partner with you know, Address for Success or other programs that offer it, you know, interviewing, and because I know some of the interviewing places offer the dressing up for an interview as part of their programs.
Lisa,
but changing the dress code is also a great idea also.
I know, Lisa, that the insight when we did a training together in Boston, one of the insight that we came away with was that even though parents were sitting at mixed tables in this training with professionals and other parents, we found out later that they didn't feel 100% empowered to ask questions. And we decided that next time we were going to have space for them to meet with other parents first before they join the other group. So I think that goes to the comment about having more opportunities for parents to meet in preparation for the bigger meeting, so that they can really hash out their questions and opinions and get support for presenting them as a part of leadership development. Just wanted to share that because it was such an aha moment in our training. Stephanie asked.
On our Zoom call.
Huh? Oh, sorry.
I said Anne on our Zoom call.
Anne on our Zoom calls, yeah. Stephanie adds, also agree that's a great strategy in making sure there's a point person for the parents so that they know where to ask questions. That's a great point. All right. Any more reflections, questions? I'd love to.
And Julia, I also wanted to add that if anyone has a question that they want to send along, if it's okay with Anthony and Lisa, I'd be happy to share them with them privately if there's a question that you want to ask. Anthony and Lisa, is that okay with you?
Always.
Yes, that's fine.
I'll put my email address in the chat box, but the follow-up email will come from me as well.
Any other thoughts? I guess one of my questions to the audience, to all those y'all participating, is, you know, what are, when Anthony was talking about the five commitments and when Lisa was talking about some of the barriers, I'd love to hear from some of you what you've done in your communities, heard from Volusia about an alternative workaround for the felony issue. But what have you done to eliminate barriers? What are some practices that you've taken on that have really worked to make things accessible and empowering for families?
This is Lynn and Volusia again.
Hi.
Hi there. I think one of the things is paying parents for their time. I know you mentioned that a little bit earlier, but I think it's really important to value their time as much as the people who are staff people getting paid to be at whatever meeting is going on. So in whatever method that could be, I know you said sometimes there's problems with stipends, but maybe it could be a gas card, something for childcare, I don't know, but some value on their time.
Anthony says, yeah, Tracy. And I know Lisa has some opinions about that as well. Do you want to add anything, Lisa? No pressure. So other cool things that people have said, Tracy also said all of our external communications include images of men with young children. Maybe that's what you were saying. Yeah, Tracy. Whoever was just talking from Volusia, and I am so sorry, I have amnesia when it comes to names. That is a point that has been talked about a lot in our parent group, and we put a very high value on the value of parents' time. So Fahim says, and I again apologize if I've mispronounced your name. We host regular parent meetings in order to hear their concerns and cares to better develop programs as well as advocacy opportunities. And Mary, who is from Guilford County, says, agree about paying families. We haven't figured this out yet. We provide gas cards, dinner, a drawing for a gift card, but would like to move to paying families for time. All ideas for how to make this work well would be much appreciated. I know some agencies have, I know that at the Great Start Collaborative in Kent County, there are different methods. For example, there's a per meeting rate, meaning that if a parent representative goes to a meeting, it is a certain, like, agreed upon pay rate and the parent gets a check. There's others that are, well, if you're going to be part of an advisory committee and you're expected to put in a certain amount of time per month, where there is a, you know, estimation of an hourly commitment and pay for that. Any other ideas?
Please. I would say, Mary, the one thing that you can do is if it's not already in there, a line item in your budget, and it might just have to be a line item for that particular committee or that meeting that day, but that can be one way to attack that.
I've always called it, in my budgeting, parent incentives, or just parent support. So you can include it in, or you can just include it in meetings, you know, like meetings and conferences, just build it into that line item, depending on how you budget. And in Ramsey, okay, and I'm saying N Lee, because that's what I see. I'm sure your name is not N, but in Ramsey County, Minnesota, I'm personally surveying at least 300 families to assess their concerns and needs for early childhood resources so I can truly gather the resources to work with them to implement what they find valuable. Awesome. That's great. Any other ideas about paying families, since that was thrown out as all ideas for make this work well, would be much appreciated.
Yeah, I mean, like in Boston, we generally just do gift cards. It's mostly Target or Shaw's because that's the main supermarket. And we provide childcare and we provide dinner or breakfast, lunch, depending on what it is. And that's how we've always built it, because to get the families through the door, we feed them and we provide the childcare. And that's how we have always done it. And that's how we have always pushed for it that way.
Absolutely. Stephanie says, I wonder if, with regard to the surveying in Minnesota, I wonder if that's a great opportunity to bring in some parents to join the surveying. That's a great point. Stipends, and then Enley said, stipends, does the payment of a set stipend incentive, for example, $50, cause tax consequences?
Not if you pay in a gift card.
So that's a good point. If you pay in a gift card, you can avoid issues of tax consequences, and also if someone doesn't have a tax ID. So that's one thing. The other thing is that I think the most important thing is to provide the information about possible tax impact to a parent when they're, filling out a stipend form. So, for example, for most agencies, if you pay for outside services over $600 in a tax year, in a calendar year, you have to file, you have to submit that information to the IRS and send the person a 1099. And so depending on their situation, that could have a tax impact. However, if they're not, that's for them to decide. I would say provide the information and let parents decide. And if they have questions, they can help them find answers.
Not to open up a can of worm, but that's why we do the gift cards, because then we don't have to ask whether they're documented or undocumented, whether they're receiving other forms of services like SSI, and because we see a lot of children with disability, and So we just do the gift cards and no questions asked.
That's a great point. It can also be tricky for parents who have other services if they receive any kind of income. It could bounce them out of the qualifying income. And so I think it's a conversation. Heather says, hello, not wanting to change the subject, just to add my question to the chat. I work at a family center. Last year, we included parents in our grant review process and requests for proposals to support cross-sector partnerships for children's, for services for families with pregnant mothers, baby, and children 0 to 3. Their input was invaluable and impacted our grant decisions. So far, that's the only way we've been able to engage parents in our early childhood strategy. Does anyone have on the call have advice about how philanthropy can better engage parents, given we are a step removed from direct services? I just wanted to ask one follow-up question to that. I think it's fantastic that it impacted your grant decisions. Curious, how did you communicate back to the parents about the impact that they had? Because that's often a missing link.
I'm a little curious about this because that's why I joined the United Way grant review last year. And then I also did the Children's Hospital. I was on their grant review because Children's Hospital, they asked for 2 parents. And generally, parents were not on grant reviews, which I thought that was interesting that parents weren't involved on these. But the other problem was that at the same time, parents weren't being paid. We did it as a volunteer, and it was a lot of work to do grant review, a lot of work. So I'm interested to see, did you pay your parents to do your grant review?
And Heather's mic isn't working, so we'll hear from her in chat. Oh, and Erin says she can't unmute Heather, so sorry about the technical difficulties. Heather said, I'm not sure that we actually did anything specific to communicate impact to parents. We had cross-departmental group of staff, donors, as well as parents on this panel, so we communicated with them as a group. And I would just recommend, I think it's a great idea to always put in a plan if you're going to solicit input in whatever way, whether it's a focus group, a survey, an advisory committee, to make sure that the specific impact, like let's say, you know, because of parent input, you gave more grants to playground development. I'm just making that up. Healthy playground space. That would be communicating that back to the parents who participated, whether it's in a newsletter or in a, you know, visiting them at their meeting or however it is that you are helping them to build trust with the system, because they're like, oh, something I said actually made a difference. They'll be more likely to want to participate next time. Stephanie says, when we did grant review in my old job, we used to figure out a number of hours and created the stipend to match that. Heather says, the parents were recommended to us from the family in Independence Initiative, and they were able to provide stipends to parents, I think. And Anthony says, make it a point to find out. Yep, these are all really good questions.
If it's from FFI, then they definitely got paid, because I know that organization.
Yes, right, because that's the family in, wait a minute. The
FFI, yeah, they always pay their parents, so I'm pretty confident they got paid.
Yeah, that's great. Thumbs up. Any other comments, questions, challenges people want input in? Thoughts about what you're struggling with? We're in a safe space, so people can say, if you're really struggling with something systemically, I think it's a great thing to just speak it out loud, because the only way we're going to change systemic issues.
My only other advice for the philanthropy is that if you have any grants that involve impact on children and families, parents should be involved. And you guys do give out a lot of money to grants for children and families, so they should have parents on those.
Right. So, for example, even as early as when you're figuring out your grant priorities, ask the parents who are natural leaders in their communities first, or who are leaders in other organizations that are within the impact circle, you know, like other grants, other grantees. Just ask early, ask often. And I guess the other thing is that there has to be a way to be flexible in terms of if you say we're going to fund playgroups and parents say we really need, you know, or the, if you say you're going to fund playgroups and centers and parents say, no, we really want playgroups to be in rec centers or, you know, more casual setting, you know, have the flexibility to work on implementing that. And Fahim says, any advice on how to build a parent network that reflects our community in terms of race, gender, etc.?
So just to be really mindful that parent network should really reflect who it is that is your community. So if your community is made up of mostly, like, let's say Latino, then you should have, you know, Latinos on that community, but it also should be everyone in that community. So it shouldn't just be Latinos. But a lot of times I look at a lot of these parent networks and it doesn't reflect anyone in their network. Because I, you know, like let's say the Donald McKay School, for instance, as an example, they're so proud that they're 95% Latino school, but the teachers are 95% white. How is that so? How are they, you know, that makes no sense to me. So, and then you go to parent teachers night, and half the time the teachers can't communicate to the families that come in and they sign off translator. That tells you that there's an issue. Why aren't they hiring more bilingual teachers?
Right. Anthony, anything for advice on how to build a parent network that reflects our community in terms of race, gender, etc.?
Yeah, I was just typing it out. I would just say go to where those parents are. I mean, I don't know what your community is made up of, but you might need to go to like a barber shop. You might need to go to a beauty shop. You might need to go to a rec center. It all, you know, I don't know what kind of parents that are predominantly in your area, but you have to go to where they are and be genuine when you speak to them. Because like I said, all you need really is maybe one or two parents who are sincere about what you were trying to do and they are on the same page with you. And then they'll get the word out to their friends because they're going to be kind of like-minded. That's who you hang out with.
So we are coming up on the end, and I know we're starting to lose people who have schedules. So I want to move to next steps, but I want for us to give, you know, big shout out to Anthony and Lisa for their contributions and their wisdom and taking the time to be a part of this. And thanks to Aaron for setting it all up. You're amazing. And we're going to head into questions. We've got Q&A kind of covered. But Aaron, how about you go through this slide?
Sure. So there will be a recording of this webinar available soon on our website at cssp.org. We will also be sending out in the follow-up email links to the manifesto and the Ripples of Transformation Toolkit, which is our Families Leading Change and Early Childhood Systems Toolkit. So you'll get a link to that as well. And right. Malia will tell you a little bit about our assessment next.
Yes, so the tool that's been most recently developed is, it's in a, do we have a slide on this? I can't remember.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's
so it's a parent engagement and leadership assessment tool. And it's an opportunity. It kind of takes the concepts and ideas and practices that are in the Ripples toolkit and in the manifesto and puts it in a self-assessment form. And it is, there are options for taking a very comprehensive assessment, and there's also a briefer, abridged version. But it's an amazing opportunity to kind of figure out where you are as an organization and map out strategies from that place. In Boston, they're using it as a part of the Boston Family Engagement Network is using it as part of a grant strategy with the Boston Children's Hospital. It also has questions. I want to, for the people who are representing funders on the call, there's also a section that is questions for grant makers and other intermediaries that you can use to shape internal conversations for change strategies with your own agency. We're going to send this as follow-up, but on April 11th, there is going to be, and unfortunately the date isn't on the slide, the Strengthening Families webinar is going to focus on this assessment. And I believe Lisa is going to be back talking about implementing the assessment in Boston with family centers, and as well as Aditi, who is the coordinator of BFEN, and myself. So that's an opportunity. If you want a deep dive into this tool, you can register at the link below.
And I'll send that out as well, that link, and this PowerPoint.
So this was just our last slide. We love this idea that you just need to start somewhere. Don't get into, as Anthony said, analysis paralysis. Know that if you want to make a change, it might get a little messy, but that's how you learn. And add it all at once, but start somewhere. Accept that you'll make mistakes and learn from them. That is all we got. So do you want to make some closing thank yous, Erin?
Thank you again to Anthony and Lisa and Malia and Stephanie for your work getting this together. And thank you to the National Collaborative for Infants and Toddlers for asking for this webinar. We hope it was helpful. So I hope everybody has a great day. And happy early birthday, Anthony.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Yeah, it's nice to finally be 21.
You don't look a day over 19.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.